From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! South Korean police are tightening a security noose around a Seoul cathedral where a top strike leader is hiding from arrest. We'll look at South Korea and U.S. policy. Also, while a hoopla continues around the Florida couple who taped Newt Gingrich, we'll have a conversation on electronic surveillance and the FBI.
If you're interested in listening to police calls, you can turn to the police frequency and hear what the cops are doing. In some countries, that's illegal. In fact, in England, that's illegal. And sometimes the police put fake calls on there just to trap people. Once they did this with, they reported a UFO had landed on top of a hill. And when all these people were climbing the hill to see where the UFO was, they were arrested for listening to the wrong frequency. So it gets a little absurd sometimes when they try to regulate things like this.
All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. When is a public hearing not a public hearing? It's become almost a joke. We now know that about 1 p.m. today, the Ethics Committee will hold a public hearing into the findings that Newt Gingrich violated ethics rules. The House Committee has tentatively scheduled this public hearing for this afternoon and this evening on the violations, but has now appeared to back off, especially yesterday, after Republicans learned that the outside counsel's report on the case is very critical of Mr. Gingrich. The development was confirmed late yesterday by House aides from both parties. Democratic aides say the report by James Cole, the committee's independent counsel, also recommends a heavy fine for Gingrich and calls for referring the case to the Justice Department for further investigation. What makes it difficult for the press is that they don't know exactly when the hearing will be. It makes it harder to broadcast it around the country, and I think there's no coincidence there. Workers who are forced to pay union dues are entitled to know how the money is spent. This, according to the National Labor Relations Board. The ruling, reported today by the Wall Street Journal, means that unions must supply financial information to workers who pay dues but have not joined a union. Workers must request the information as part of their attempt to seek a refund of dues not spent on collective bargaining. Author Salman Rushdie has criticized a British newspaper today for printing derogatory statements by his former wife, who left him months after he drew an Iranian death sentence in 1989. In a letter to The Guardian, Rushdie said he wanted to set the record straight after his ex-wife, Marion Wiggins, described him as self-obsessed and accused him of failing to support other authors whose lives were threatened because of their work. Jewish settlers mourned and Palestinians celebrated Israel's handover today of most of Hebron to PLO rule after 30 years of occupation. Underscoring the volatility of the West Bank town, Palestinians hurled stones and handfuls of produce at Israeli soldiers during a brief confrontation near the Arab market, which remains under Israeli control. No one was hurt. And the resistance to Indonesian rule in East Timor plans to form a shadow government, according to Nobel laureate José Ramos Horta. He told Portugal's news agency Lusa during a visit to Macau that up to two-thirds of the so-called shadow government would be made up of activists in hiding in Indonesia or East Timor. Explosive experts resume their search in this country for clues today in the wreckage left by two bomb blasts that injured half a dozen people outside an Atlanta abortion clinic. As the investigation at the clinic began, police and federal agents were expected to renew heightened security at other Atlanta-area abortion clinics to reassure clinic workers and guard against a similar attack. Investigators had called off the search for a possible third device at the scene and concentrated on finding clues in the two blasts. Robert Browning, an agent with the U.S. Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, said the area has been determined to be clear. The bombings, about an hour apart, rocked a building housing the Atlanta Northside Family Planning Services Center in suburban Sandy Springs yesterday, the same clinic that was the target of Atlanta's last abortion clinic bombing 13 years ago. The first bomb exploded about 9:30 Eastern Standard Time. An hour later, as federal law enforcement officials and local firefighters sifted through the debris, a second bomb detonated near a garbage container at the corner of the building's parking lot, injuring six people, including agents from the FBI and ATF. Police say there's no warning of the attack and no one claimed responsibility. The attack happened just as a news conference was happening in Washington, D.C., where feminist groups were laying out the record around abortion clinics over the last year and violent attacks on them. Through a poor PA system, Ellie Smeal of the Feminist Majority spoke.
On December 18th in New Orleans, a doctor entering a clinic was attacked by an assailant after he was asked, is he the doctor? And he said, yes. He was stabbed 15 times about the head, the neck, and the chest. He required 5 units of blood. This was not a little assault. This was a serious assault. The assailant then, we believe, traveled to Baton Rouge and was lying in wait for yet a second doctor when he was arrested inside a clinic. And he was arrested, really, on a lesser charge. It took nearly 2 weeks for the law enforcement to connect him to the assault in New Orleans. And the only reason that it was discovered that indeed there was a match was because of the vigilance of the pro-choice advocates.
Ellie Smeal was followed by Vicky Saporta of the National Abortion Federation.
The stabbing of a doctor in Louisiana, which Ellie described, the bombing of a clinic in Oklahoma, the blockade of a clinic in Rochester, all incidents within the past month demonstrate and remind us of the threatening reality that providers live with every day. Here in Washington this weekend, anti-choice activists across the country are expected to lay siege to clinics. They have openly announced that they plan to break the law and blockade at least one clinic. During this time, they will also hold their annual White Rose Banquet, a dinner that's organized by convicted clinic bomber Michael Bray to honor and support those who commit violence against abortion providers. And at this dinner, historically, they actively encourage their supporters to go out and perpetrate violence against abortion providers.
And that was Vicky Saporta and Ellie Smeal, both at a news conference yesterday in Washington, D.C., going through the record of violence at women's health clinics. Just as they were getting started, they heard the news of the 2 bombings at the Atlanta clinic. And you're listening to Democracy Now! South Korean police are tightening a security noose around a Seoul cathedral where a top strike leader is hiding from arrest, and the ruling camp scorned a dramatic offer by the fugitive for a televised debate. Special force officers trained in unarmed combat guarded approaches to Myeongdong's cathedral while police checked cars approaching the building. The so-called grabbers, hardened by years of street fighting, are deployed during riots to rush into crowds and make arrests. South Korea's Roman Catholic cardinal appealed to President Kim Il-sung during a meeting to resolve the current situation with dialogue, a presidential spokesperson said. For more than 3 weeks, South Korea has been hit by a wave of nationwide strikes. Workers are protesting the secret passage of a new labor law that gives sweeping powers to big Korean corporations like Samsung, Hyundai, and Daewoo. If the new law remains, it will be much easier for corporations to lay off workers, replace strikers, extend work hours, and lower wages. At the same time, the government of President Kim Il-sung also passed a law giving new powers to the Agency for National Security Planning, also known as the Korean CIA. We're joined now by 2 people to explain the situation, not only what's happening in South Korea today, but to talk about U.S. policy towards Korea. We're joined by Tim Shorrock, who is an American journalist who's covered Korea extensively. He currently writes for the Journal of Commerce. He wrote a piece last December in The Nation magazine called Debacle at Gwangju, which outlined the U.S. role in the 1980 Gwangju massacre. We're also joined by Jin-Suk Lee, the director of the Korea Information Project, a clearinghouse and resource center based here in Washington, D.C. And we're joined in New York by Juan Gonzalez, my co-host, columnist with the Daily News. Welcome, Juan.
Good morning, Amy.
Good to have you with us. Well, talking about Korea, let's turn first to Jin-Suk Lee. Can you describe what is happening right now in your best information in South Korea?
Right now, as you said, since December 26, South Korean workers have been on strike in protest of the passage of labor laws. Right now, you have tensions increasing in terms of the police there attempting to arrest the union leaders. They've already arrested actually 4 of the union leaders in another city in South Korea, in Mokpo. And, you know, there's been reports that the number of striking workers changes. I mean, you know, according to the government, it's in the figures of 10, 20,000 people. In terms of the unions, it's more than that.
And what are the relationships between, there are two major labor federations there, one that is more amenable to the government usually. What's been the relationship? Because we've heard reports that on some occasions one federation has called its workers out, and others it's told them to go back in.
Well, the thing that you have to make it very clear is that both federations, you have the FKTU, which is the Federation of Korean Trade Unions, that's sponsored and sanctioned by the South Korean government. And then you also have the Korean Confederation of Trade Unions, which is the KCTU, that is not recognized by the South Korean government. They're both in support of the general strike, and they're both working together in terms of the strike, and they've called for all of its members to participate in the general strike. Now, for the KCTU, this general strike is crucial because one of the components of the labor reforms is that it disallows their legitimacy for another 3 years.
Can you explain who Kwon Young-kil, the president of the Korean Confederation of Trade Unions, is? He's the man who's challenged the chairman of the new Korean party to hold a public debate over the new labor law, and he's the one that they're surrounding the cathedral over.
Right. Kwon Young-kil, he is the president of KCTU. He has been in prison for labor activities, and he used to be a former correspondent in Paris. He has been instrumental in terms of the KCTU, the success of the KCTU, and without him, there's a lot of concern that the KCTU could maintain its strength in South Korea.
Let me jump in here a little bit. This is Tim Shorrock. The KCTU was organized in the 80s at a time when the Federation of Korean Trade Unions was the only recognized trade union group in South Korea. The FKTU has historically been not necessarily pro-government, but it's never really opposed the government. And during the 1980s, there was very severe repression of Korean workers, and the KCTU was formed in industries where unions had never been allowed, particularly the large export industries, companies like Hyundai, Samsung, and Daewoo, where they were competing in the world economy, and the Korean corporations did not want to have any unions. Shipyards, for example, and this is also where Korea had some of the highest industrial accident rates in the world. Conditions were very poor. It took years and years for them to organize this federation, and they're the ones who really went out who called the strike, organized the strike, and it took the FKTU quite a few weeks to get it together to join. However, as was mentioned before, they are united in opposing these labor laws, which not only continue to ban on the Korean Confederation, but also there's one law provision of this law called the Third Party Intervention Law, which has been used in the past to keep religious and other groups outside of unions from being involved with the labor movement. Many Christian leaders have been arrested under this law before, but it's also used to keep union leaders from taking part in any kind of labor action. For example, if you were a president of a union federation and you were not directly employed at a factory and that factory goes on strike, under this law you may not make a speech supporting that strike. And Mr. Kwon, who is the president of the Korean Confederation, was arrested about a year and a half ago for speaking out on behalf of a subway strike. So it's really a freedom of speech issue, as well as a violation of norms accepted by the International Labor Organization on freedom of association.
Well, Tim Shorrock, in terms of the relationship of this strike to the general situation for labor unions around the world, there hasn't been a whole lot of attention. Finally, today there was a front page article in the New York Times on the Korean labor conflict. But generally speaking, there has been very little media attention in this country compared, let's say, to the attention given the solidarity movement or other democracy movements, even in other parts of the world. What in the growing internationalization of and the exporting of production to the third world, what is the importance of this strike for, let's say, union members here in the United States or in other countries?
Well, I think in history there's been very few instances of such a united labor movement striking in unity against a government, an oppressive government. There's very few instances of this in this century, and I think workers all over the world should look to South Korea for an example on this. There hasn't been anything like this in this country. And I think it's also important that for many years South Korea was seen as and still is described as an economic miracle. In the 70s and 80s, there were many articles in the business press that basically the line was Korean workers are willing to accept anything as a way to climb out of poverty. And willing to accept, I could quote, articles from Fortune, Forbes, Wall Street Journal for years and years. Korean workers are willing to accept any kind of conditions, any kind of poor working conditions, pollution, just as a way to become an industrialized country. And people forgot that Korean workers, like workers most everywhere, want to have the right to speak out, want to have the right to join their organizations, and are human beings like anybody else. And they will stand up for their rights when their rights are threatened.
Jin Suk Lee, what is the role that the corporations like Samsung, Hyundai, these corporations play in making laws like these?
I mean, obviously, the new labor reforms are more beneficial to corporations, and there is a close connection between corporations and the government, and they are in support of the labor reforms because, in their eyes, it would make them more competitive in the global economy.
And what about why, on the same day, there were two laws passed, one around labor and the other around these new powers to the Agency for National Security Planning, known as the Korean CIA?
Right. Point
is, it obvious? Is it that you have to repress in order to, if you're going to make these stricter labor laws, you're going to have to repress the people?
I don't know if your listeners know this. Aside from passing those laws, it's the way they were passed. They were passed in 7 short minutes without any members of the opposition party there, without any discussion.
Is it true that they all stayed in hotels right around the, what is it called, the parliament building? And then they were brought over?
They bust them in.
Yeah. And they bust them in so that the opposition wouldn't suspect that they were going in?
Well, the opposition were waiting at the National Assembly for
a regular meeting.
For a regular meeting, or for any signs of what the ruling party was going to do. And so knowing that, they sidetracked and went into a hotel and they voted. They passed 11 laws, and part of that was the labor reform bill, but also reinstating the powers to the Agency for National Security Planning to what they had during the military dictatorship. And there's a lot of concern right now because the rhetoric or the arguments that has been coming out of the South Korean government has been, that members or parts of the labor union units is an ideological bent, and using the rhetoric of communism. So there's a concern of trying to tie in these two reforms.
Getting back go ahead.
I'd like to ask Tim Shorrock, has there been, what's been the position of the Clinton administration, which loves to rail about the question of human rights and democratic rights in other countries, to this growing crisis in Korea?
Well, they just consider this a domestic matter and have said hardly anything about it at all. I think in terms of the Clinton's foreign policy toward Korea, they are engaged in discussions with North Korea, which actually have been quite fruitful, and I think are important in the sense of trying to decrease tensions in the Korean Peninsula. But vis-a-vis South Korea, I think the Clinton administration is fooling of itself if it believes that not saying anything is going to give itself any kind of credibility among Korean workers there are many hundreds of thousands of Korean workers who are looking for outside support for their struggles there.
When we come back, I just want to ask you quickly about the piece you did in The Nation about the massacre at Gwangju in 1980 and the U.S. administration, including people like Warren Christopher, now the outgoing Secretary of State, and what he had to do with it. And then after that, we're going to talk about privacy on the Internet, privacy on phones and cellular phones, and we're also going to talk about law enforcement like the FBI here in this country. You're listening to Democracy Now! We're speaking with Jin-Suk Lee, Director of the Korea Information Project, and Tim Shorrock, a reporter with the Journal of Commerce based here in Washington, D.C. Stay with us. Listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers, and we're still joined by Jin-Suk Lee of the Korea Information Project and Tim Shorrock of the Journal of Commerce, who grew up in Japan and Korea, has spent a lot of time in Korea, and recently wrote a piece in The Nation, as well as the Journal of Commerce, and also on the web, a piece called Debacle in Gwangju. Can you talk about what this massacre in 1980 has to do with U.S. foreign policy today?
Well, in 1980, there was a military takeover, and it happened right after hundreds of people in the southwestern city of Gwangju were massacred by special forces known as Black Berets in South Korea. This incident created a terrible stain in U.S.-Korean relations that are never going to be erased, is never going to be erased until the United States really apologizes and takes full measure for what its responsibility was at that time. My article in the Journal of Commerce and The Nation magazine was based on hundreds of documents I obtained under the Freedom of Information Act, which showed how the U.S. Basically was trying to prevent another Iran in the making in South Korea in 1979 and 1980 after a previous dictator was assassinated, and tried to have kind of a middle ground between right-wing military rulers and conservative politicians that they thought could make a safe government that would be supportive of U.S. interests. And this plan collapsed. The key individuals involved with this plan that have played a key role in the Clinton administration were Richard Holbrooke, who at that time was the Assistant Secretary of State for East Asia and Pacific Affairs, and Warren Christopher, who is just retiring as Secretary of State, who was Jimmy Carter's Deputy Secretary of State. The documents show that the United States, while not ordering the massacre in Gwangju, was fully aware that special forces, these Black Berets, were being sent there, and were being sent there with the purpose of putting down large-scale demonstrations. The documents also show that the massacre occurred on May 18th. The documents show that as early as May 8th, the United States ambassador in South Korea, William Gleystein, met with Chun Doo-hwan, who at that time was this military ruler, and basically gave him the green light to use troops that are under U.S.-Korean joint command to put down large-scale labor and student unrest. And there are many other documents which show U.S. Cooperation with that government at that time.
You recently got a chance to talk to Richard Holbrooke, didn't you?
I did, and Richard Holbrooke strongly defends his role here, and he believes that by helping Korea through this period, South Korea became a democracy and an economic power.
But Tim Shorrock, that democracy supposedly came many years later, after a period of a tense dictatorship.
Absolutely
in,
right.
In the country. To what degree do you think that what is happening now, because the American public has been hearing now that South Korea has developed a democracy in recent years, although we rarely heard very much about that long period of military dictatorship. To what degree do you think the incidents now and the general strike now and the government's response may be an indication of a turn back to that period?
I think there's very dangerous signs, as we were saying before, that by calling these guys pro-North Korean, they're setting the stage for arresting them. But I think with world attention on South Korea right now, with groups like the AFL-CIO and other international labor organizations following these events very closely and saying they're going to react if there is a wave of arrests, the situation is different. And you're absolutely right. The United States did not help South Korea become a democracy. It was the people themselves fighting in the streets, battling for days in the 1980s against a government that we supported every step of the way.
As we wrap up, I wanted to ask Jin Suk Lee two questions. One is, what reunification of Korea, if it has anything to do with this issue of the strikers in South Korea? And also, what about the response of the international community? How significant is that?
What's has to be very clear here in terms of the general strike, it's a trade union struggle. It's a strike that is opposing the labor reforms. So I think that has to be very clear in that, because that's what the South Korean government is trying to tie in and with the Agency for National Security Planning to make that into other than a labor strike. In terms of the international community, the support of the international community is crucial, because the argument that Kim Il-sung government has been using is that these labor reforms are in line with the international standards of the ILO and the Human Rights Commission, the UN Human Rights Commission. The KCTU, Kwan Young-gir, is asking and pressing for international support. And I think they've been doing an excellent job in getting that. You had a delegation from ICFTU and even a delegation from AFL-CIO in the U.S. who went into South Korea at the request of the KCTU and the other trade unions. And also there have been a whole day of support and demonstrations from the consulates and the embassy in response to the request from the KCTU. And only with the support and scrutiny of the international community will the Kim Il-sung government, I think, resolve in a manner that is not such a harsh crackdown as what they had anticipated in the beginning.
I know in the last week, the AFL-CIO has held protests outside of the Korean consulate in New York, as well as Washington and New York. It was just yesterday.
Last Friday, there was a demonstration at the Korean embassy.
Right, here in Washington.
Which is a very important step, because in the past, the AFL-CIO did not support the independent unions in Korea. In fact, played a role where they only supported the pro-government federation and lost a lot of credibility with Korean workers. And this is a very important step.
Jin Suk Lee, any phone number that people can call if they want to get more information on what's going on in Korea?
They can call our office, and our phone number is 703-941-8585.
One more time?
703-941-8585. What we're trying to do at this point is also to get a lot of support letters from different organizations, and particularly right now the Catholic Church, since the trade unionists are at Myeongdong Cathedral, which is a place of sanctuary, and historically a lot of activists have been there. Incidentally, Kwan Young-gil was arrested at the cathedral when he was participating in the strikes, the subway workers' strike in 1995, where the police used force and raided the cathedral. So we're trying very much trying to stop that occurring.
So why don't you give that number out one more time, and especially for organizations that might want to write letters in solidarity.
It's 703-941-8585.
I want to thank you both very much for joining us. Jin Suk Lee, director of the Korea Information Project, a clearinghouse and resource center based here in Washington, D.C., and Tim Shorrock, an American journalist working now at the Journal of Commerce, who has been covering Korea for many years. His piece in The Nation magazine was put out in the December 9th edition. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And you're listening to Democracy Now! We move now from the Korean CIA over to the United States to talk about law enforcement here in what legal observers call a startling development. A U.S. federal court last month ruled that the FBI could amass and keep, for as long as it deemed necessary, any and all information it gathers on the legal activities of Americans. And just 3 days ago, the FBI said it wanted telephone companies to give police the capability ability to tap as many as 60,000 simultaneous phone conversations. Today, we're going to look at some recent and worrying trends involving the FBI, electronic surveillance, and the right to privacy. Now, we've heard a lot about tapping of phones recently, or at least recording of phones, because of the Martins in Florida taping a phone conversation they heard through their police scanner, and it was a phone conversation of Newt Gingrich and the Republican leadership. We all know what has happened since that tape went over to Jim McDermott at the House Ethics Committee. He has since said that he will recuse himself from considerations of Newt Gingrich because of questions raised about the legality of that tape. And this is why we're taking on this issue of privacy today. But we thought we'd take it on to look at who might be an organization that might be the greatest violator of individual rights and privacy, and that is the FBI, not to mention the National Security Agency. Joining us right now to talk about a very interesting case that has just been a judge has just ruled on is Kate Martin, the director of the Center for National Security Studies, a Washington, D.C.-based civil liberties advocacy and public education organization. Kate, I wanted you first to comment about this this request of the FBI to tap 60,000, to listen to 60,000 phone conversations at once, and then to talk about this case that you've been involved with that involves the FBI in keeping secret files.
Yes. Well, Amy, maybe if I'll start with the second one first. We, some years ago, on behalf of the J. Roderick MacArthur Foundation and its president, Lance Lindblom, at the time, this is the smaller of the two MacArthur Foundations, discovered that the FBI was keeping a file on Lance Lindblom and the foundation. And when we asked for it under the Freedom of Information Act on behalf of them, of our clients, they refused to give it to us on national security grounds. We sued the FBI, claiming that we had a right to see the file, and our clients asked for expungement of the file, saying they had no basis or legitimacy in keeping a national security file on their activities. The small part of the files that were released showed that the FBI was collecting information on the political activities of Lance Lindblom, which were protected by the First Amendment. Specifically, in fact, they had a notation that he had gone to South Korea in the mid-'80s to accompany an opposition politician, in fact, back there, and to protect him when he got off the plane. The FBI litigated very furiously for many years, took the position that we weren't entitled to see anything else in the file, that they weren't going to tell us why they had opened the file, and that they weren't going to give any basis for continuing to keep the file other than that their say-so was that national security required keeping the file. As you mentioned, last month we lost in the district court and appealed. The Court of Appeals in the District of Columbia ruled 2-1 that the FBI could keep such files without showing any current need or any law enforcement justification for keeping such files, simply on the basis that the information was originally collected legally. There was a dissent by Judge Tatel who said that the Privacy Act had been enacted specifically to fight against and protect against the tendencies of government towards Big Brother and this kind of amassing of personal and even political data on individuals.
We should point out that it was Judge Douglas Ginsburg, right, who wrote the opinion for the D.C. Circuit, the man who was turned down as a possible Supreme Court justice because of marijuana.
Yes, and there is an irony in some ways about this case, because one of the things about the case is that Mr. Lindblom, who was president of this foundation and now works at the Ford Foundation, has a permanent FBI file on him. While the FBI argues that they keep those files to themselves and that the existence of the file themselves isn't harmful because they keep them secret. That file will be made available if Mr. Lindblom ever were to be considered for any kind of federal employment or grants or anything.
Well, Kate Martin, this in essence means that the FBI has an ever-growing a base of information on citizens rather than one that would only be adjusted to their particular needs as a law enforcement agency. What in terms of the dangers that this poses long term to the American public? What do you see happening?
Well, it is exactly as you say, that they begin to amass dossiers on individuals. You know, the FBI is structured so that it has a criminal division where they collect information on crimes and on people suspected of crimes. And that's not half of the problem. The problem is on the other half of the FBI, which is the foreign counterintelligence half. And there they have much looser rules about when they collect information. Basically, they collect information on Americans who meet with, talk with foreigners who they suspect. And if you meet or talk to the wrong person or have some kind of political activity with a wrong group, the FBI is likely to open a file on you. Once the file's been opened, every time you come within their scope again in the future, they're going to add that information to your file. And this is, of course, the method of intelligence gathering that's used by the secret police and communist and totalitarian governments. It's just to keep information on political activities of its citizens on the theory that it will be useful someday. And as the dissenting judge pointed out, the more information you have in government files about people's First Amendment protected activities, the more likely it is that that information is going to be abused. One of the things the FBI says is, oh, well, we have all these rules in there, all these laws saying we can't abuse or use this information in some wrong way. Well, there's a lot of loopholes and difficulties with that. And, you know, as we've seen, the FBI files get sent over to the White House when they shouldn't have been sent over to the White House. The FBI also is in a position to share the information in its intelligence files with security services overseas, and you would never know about it. And if you're active in kind of international human rights work or any kind of international work, you risk having this kind of secret information being shared back and forth.
And in the Court of Appeals decision, the two Republican-appointed judges ruled against you, and the one appointed by the Clinton administration ruled for you. But isn't this, with both Democrats and Republicans talking about smaller government and reducing bureaucracy, it seems the one area where they don't mind bigger government and more intrusion is in law enforcement and intelligence gathering.
I'm afraid that is true, that many people who are otherwise libertarian in their instincts when it comes to bigger government in the name of national security and law enforcement lose those libertarian instincts.
Before we move on to the FBI possibly tapping 60,000 phone conversations at once, I wanted to ask you about a strange twist in the case of J. Roderick MacArthur Foundation and Lance Lindblom versus the FBI, and that is the revelation that the FBI officer involved in the proceedings was Earl Pitts, who has just been indicted as a Russian spy.
Yes, it's a great irony. The FBI in the case has been going on for a number of years. In the early 90s, submitted an affidavit to the court. It was their key affidavit, and in fact, it's the only affidavit that in the end mattered in the case from this FBI agent Earl Pitts. It now turns out that at the time that he wrote the affidavit, the FBI says that he was spying for Russia. The affidavit was the basis in which the FBI claimed, first of all, that the files were classified and they couldn't show them to us. It was also the basis in which the FBI claimed that the information had originally been collected legally. And the day before the decision was reached, actually, the government's lawyers notified the court that their chief key witness was, in fact, accused of being a Russian spy.
So I guess Lance Lindblom can feel comfortable knowing his information is not only at the U.S. FBI, but at the Russian secret intelligence as well.
Yes. And, of course, he doesn't yet have access to what that information is. Another irony in the case.
You mean Lance Lindblom doesn't know what is out there on him?
Right.
Because the information he's gotten has been blacked out.
That's right.
Okay. Are you going to appeal, at least based on the Earl Pitt's involvement?
We are going to take, being in the Court of Appeals already, there are some complicated procedural alternatives, but we are going to pursue the case based both on the Privacy Act and the constitutional claim and on the involvement of the Pitts.
Kate Martin is director of the Center for National Security Studies, Washington, D.C.-based civil liberties advocacy and public education organization. We're going to come back with her and Jim Dempsey of the Center for Democracy and Technology to get to that issue of FBI listening to 60,000 phone conversations at once. You're listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back in 60 seconds. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez, our guest, Kate Martin, director of the Center for National Security Studies, and Jim Dempsey of the Center for Democracy and Technology. Well, we've teased our listeners with this request by the FBI just 3 days ago, wanting telephone companies to give police the capability to tap as many as 60,000 simultaneous phone conversations. What's this all about, Jim?
Well, in the same week that we're seeing how easy it is to intercept cellular phone conversations by a private citizen, we have the FBI coming forth under legislation that is intended to make it easier for law enforcement to carry out interceptions. The FBI has been claiming for some time that new technology in some respects makes it more difficult for government. And under legislation that Congress adopted in 1994, the FBI is now being required to put on the public record both its past practices in the area of electronic surveillance and its projected future needs. And the figure you cite of 60,000 interceptions is a figure for the year 2004, which is where the FBI thinks that it and other law enforcement agencies, it's a total national figure for all levels of law enforcement, state and local, as well as federal. And the FBI has estimated that by the year 2004, it would be expecting at peak levels to be intercepting conversations and capturing dialed number information, the sort of touchpad information as you dial your phone number, collect that on perhaps as many as 60,000 people at one time, if you were to aggregate it nationwide and think of sort of Thanksgiving Day when everybody's making a phone call to their relatives or something. It's interesting that this notice actually is far scaled back from an earlier notice that the FBI issued about 14 months ago in 1995, when they were asking for capacity in some urban areas of up to 1 in 100 lines, 1% monitoring capacity, which was far, far out of line with what anybody had thought was either past practice or any reasonable projection of the future. So actually, this 60,000 figure turns out to be a vastly scaled back proposal.
And it was actually public uproar over its initial proposals that even got it to begin scaling back to this level, isn't it?
Well, that's right. It actually was a very interesting event that occurred, the legislation that Congress passed in 1994 did require the FBI to actually come forward for the first time ever and say what its plans were in the area of electronic surveillance. And when it put this first notice forward in October of 95, there was a tremendous uproar. And interestingly enough, and I think it is sort of on the positive side, it shows how government can respond to media exposure and to public criticism. The FBI withdrew that proposal, went back to the drawing board, and came out with some very interesting data, which at least gives the public, both individual citizens and privacy organizations, something to analyze, something to dig into, to try to find out, is this in fact a realistic projection based upon current and recent historical activity?
Well, Jim Dempsey, in terms of the explosion in the forms of mass communications, is there any basis for their projection of such a need from your perspective?
Well, we've been seeing every year increases in wiretap activity. There had been some limited data published in the past. What we just got this past Tuesday is far more comprehensive, but we had been watching a regular yearly 5%, 10%, 15% growth in the use of both wiretaps, where the content of the call is intercepted, and even more higher rates of growth in the so-called pen registers and trap and trace devices, which collect the numbers dialed. And you're right, this does go back in some ways to the proliferation of communications, to the rapid evolvement into this electronic digital age. And while individual citizens are taking advantage of this technology, law enforcement has been working very hard to exploit the investigative potential of this technology as well.
Kate Martin, we've been talking about the FBI, but a much more massive organization is the National Security Agency. What role does it play in eavesdropping on Americans?
Well, it's prohibited from eavesdropping on Americans inside the United States, basically. I mean, the law requires that the government get a warrant before it can eavesdrop on anyone inside the United States. And generally, that eavesdropping is done by the FBI, not by the National Security Agency. What the NSA is directed at is international communications, which would include communications either from foreigners overseas to the United States, but which originate overseas, and communications among Americans, who both of whom happen to be overseas at the time. That those communications are much less protected under the law than domestic communications.
I mean, this is a very interesting point. The idea that every international call you make is actually being monitored, and isn't it true, looking for keywords, you might say, I guess words like bomb?
Well, that's a slight, I would say that's a slightly exaggerated description of what happens. The NSA has enormous capacity to monitor, you know, I don't know about every telephone call in the world, but many, many phone calls. But and what they do is scoop up the transmissions, and they don't listen to them, though. And then sometimes they search different areas of those transmissions by keywords.
So they have them on record, and then they do sort of word searches, sound searches.
Yes. Now, but they don't have on record telephone calls that originate in the United States. So if we call overseas, they are prohibited from monitoring those telephone calls unless they have a warrant to do so. But nevertheless, as more and more people are engaged in international communications and the capabilities of those of NSA and other government agencies increase, there is greater and greater danger here that there's this kind of enormous capability to eavesdrop. And do we really have adequate protections against doing that?
Well, I'd like to ask both Kate Martin and Jim Dempsey, with the explosion of the Internet, and obviously on your Internet calls, you're initially starting with a local phone number, but you could end up anywhere in the world. What are the dangers here in terms of interception and the limitations on government? Because I know that in Bill Gates's book, The Road Ahead, he repeatedly talks about his concerns about security on the Internet, and especially about government attempts to be able to have a free hand in intercepting or monitoring the Internet.
Well, one of the very important issues that our organization, the Center for Democracy and Technology, is working on is precisely government efforts, efforts by the U.S. government and by the international community to control the availability of strong encryption technology. There is now available the ability to protect your Internet communications, to encrypt those communications. And the U.S. government has pursued a series of very ill-considered, very poorly thought-through policies in an effort to control the availability of this technology when, in fact, it is security-enhancing technology. The government itself is worried about computer break-ins and communication security and putting strong encryption in the hands of private and business users is really the best way to protect the security of those communications.
Kate Martin, do you want to add something to that?
I want to add about what the current legal situation is, which is that when you dial up your Internet service provider, if it's a domestic U.S. phone call and you're getting into the Internet through U.S. computer, the government needs a warrant to wiretap that. And, in fact, there's a whole separate statute on eavesdropping and tapping into electronic communications. And it requires probable cause for kind of the most serious kinds of intrusions, and it always requires some kind of warrant or judicial review. And we don't want to, you know, in looking at the dangers that this technological capability pose, you know, you want to realize that at the same time, it is illegal at the moment for the federal government to eavesdrop on people without warrants. And the question kind of arises, well, is that going to be by itself enough of a protection?
We have to wrap up this conversation because we're going to end today with the comments of a hacker, Emmanuel Goldstein, and his thoughts on everything that's come up in the last week around people listening to phone conversations. But I did want to get your Internet addresses or phone numbers of where people can go to find your organizations. Jim Dempsey, Center for Democracy and Technology.
We're at www.cdt.org.
www.cdt.org.
I have a very good website there with information on electronic surveillance and other Internet civil liberties and democracy issues.
The last time we had your group on, Jen Lurie told people how you could go to your website and find out, actually learn about how you're leaving your own, what is it called?
Well, your own personal information. Every time you go onto the net and check out somebody's site, they sort of can capture, I think the term is cookies, they can capture some data about you and in some cases use that for commercial purposes and resale purposes and so on. So and there are ways to protect your privacy, and we talk about that on our website.
So, folks, for every place you go on the web, you're leaving a dropping. Kate Martin?
Our phone number is 202-994-7060.
That's 202-994-7060.
Yes.
Well, thanks very much for being with us as we turn now to Emmanuel Goldstein. I talked to him last night. He's sleeping right now. He works during the night and sleeps during the day. And he is one of the chief hackers in this country, and he's editor of a hackers magazine called 2600. And I asked him what lessons can be learned about all that's happened this week with Alice and John Martin coming forward and saying that they were the ones, this Florida couple, who were driving along in their car to do their Christmas shopping and picked up on a police scanner that they play with, a conversation that Newt Gingrich was having with other Republican leaders in the House. I think that the phone they were picking up was Republican John Boehner's, who was there in Florida. So we now go to Emmanuel Goldstein as I asked him to talk a little about what we can learn from all of this.
Well, I mean, I've been waiting for something like this to happen for a very, very long time. The law was passed back in 1986. It was a ridiculous law then. It's just as ridiculous today. Finally, we see why it's so silly. Anybody who uses an old-style cellular phone, there's still many, many people who do, is basically broadcasting their conversation to anybody who wants to listen to it. And it doesn't matter if you're on a secure landline phone. If you're talking to somebody who's using a cellular phone, someone on that end could be listening and hearing both ends of the conversation. Many people in Washington, D.C., many, many senators, congressmen, use this type of system. So people in D.C. really have a lot of things to listen to if they are daring enough to turn their scanner to 800 megahertz. Now, the idea of protecting people by simply legislating away the problem is pretty absurd for many reasons, not the least being that someone can simply turn on a radio and listen, and there's absolutely no way to tell who's doing that, nor should there be a way to tell. So that's what happened with the Newt Gingrich case, that somebody simply turned on a scanner, and there he was.
I heard some people say that they didn't believe regular scanners could pick up cellular conversations, so that the Martins, the Florida couple who ended up taping what they got from their scanner, couldn't possibly have gotten it just from a scanner from Radio Shack.
Well, it used to be very simple to get a scanner like that. It's harder now. A couple of years ago, they actually made it illegal to sell scanners that could pick up these frequencies, which is another absurd miscarriage of justice. Listening to radio frequencies is something that's passive. You're not actively going around wiretapping somebody. People are comparing this to a violation of wiretap laws. It's not wiretapping. Wiretapping involves connecting to something, invading somebody's privacy that way, not turning on a radio. It's completely, utterly different. So what these people did simply was turn on their radio and listen. Now, you can't do that with scanners that you buy today. They have to be modified in some way. There are a couple of ways of modifying it. One way involves opening it up and actually doing some soldering and modification of the circuitry. Another way of doing this is by programming. You have one scanner that has been modified, and it kind of transfers the data over to the other scanner and modifies it in that sense. It's possible that this couple somehow got a scanner that had already been modified. I can't really dismiss that possibility, but I think it's more likely that they were into listening to phone calls. A lot of us are. And they're wide open. They're out there. If you have an old television set, one of the really old ones that get all the way up to channel 83 on the UHF dial, you can actually listen to cellular conversations in that area. They no longer make channels that go up that high because they allocate some of that for the cellular band. But if you have an old TV set, you can commit a felony by basically listening to the wrong frequency.
But, Emmanuel, isn't the felony not the listening but taping?
The way the law is written, the actual interception, which would involve listening, is the crime. Obviously, doing something with it wouldn't really be permitted.